What is behind the rash of police violence against African Americans? How is it that police killings like those of Michael Brown or of Laquan McDonald can be conducted with almost complete impunity for the offenders? Are there substantive links between police brutality in Minneapolis and the flourishing of white supremacist groups there? In what ways have the freedom struggles of the 60s and 70s been successful, and where have there been failures? What are the historic roots of the problem of racist violence against Black Americans, and where do solutions lie? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we examine the phenomenon of racialized policing in Minneapolis and throughout the United States, as well as the recent explosion of anti-racism activism conceived to confront that violence. Our guests for the hour include Michelle Gross, activist with a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group, and commentator Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of Pan-African Newswire. On this week's show, Black Lives Matter, investigating the culture of impunity of racist police violence in the United States. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 4th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Illegal oil revenues are one of the main sources of income for the terrorists in Syria. According to some reports, they make about $2 billion a year on illegal oil trade. Turkey is the main destination for the oil stolen from its legitimate owners, which are Syria and Iraq. Turkey resells this oil. The appalling part about it is that the country's top political leadership is involved in the illegal business. President Erdogan and his family. That was from a speech given by Russian Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov during a December 2nd briefing. Transcribed in the article, Bombshell, Russian Military Reveals Details of ISIS-Daesh Funding, Turkey's Role in Supporting the Terrorists, Complete Transcript, Videos, Documents, by Syrian Free Press, posted December 3rd. A statistical analysis performed by George Kyorksoglu, visiting lecturer, University of Greenwich, London, and Dr. Alec D. Kutrubis, principal lecturer, University of Greenwich, London, determined that, quote, "It seems that whenever the Islamic State is fighting in the vicinity of an area hosting oil assets, the 13 exports from the Turkish state-owned oil refinery at Ceyhan promptly spike. This may be attributed to an extra boost given to crude oil smuggling with the aim of immediately generating additional funds badly needed for the supply of ammunition and military equipment." Unquote. And Zero Hedge has rounded up a variety of circumstantial evidence indicating that the Turkish leaders are intentionally smuggling ISIS oil into Turkey and then out to the Mediterranean using the same supply routes used to smuggle illegal Kurdish oil. Will the Turkish president keep his word and resign? That comes from the article, Yes, Turkey is Buying Oil from ISIS, by Washington's blog, posted December 2nd. As Mehdi Mahassan points out in The New Statesman, quote, "If bombing worked, Iraq would have morphed into a Scandinavia-style utopia long ago," unquote. Instead, the country is in chaos, breaking records for terrorist activity while ever more foreign fighters flood into the country day by day. In other cases, like Syria, the connection is less clear. What is accepted, even by American intelligence agencies, is that after the deaths of hundreds of civilians and thousands of fighters from coalition bombs, Daesh, or ISIS, is certainly no weaker now than it was a year ago. In fact, its fighter ranks may have swelled from 20,000 to 31,500 to at least 80,000 in the past year. That comes from the article, "The Entire War on Terror Has Been a Lie, and These Charts Prove It," by Rebecca Sumner, posted December 2nd, originally appearing at The Canary. In September 2014, a photo of Netanyahu and Ya'alon visiting terrorists receiving care in an Israeli hospital went viral online. Netanyahu seen shaking a terrorist's hand. According to the Al Arabi Al Jadid newspaper, quote, "Israel has in one way or another become the main marketer of ISIS oil. Without them, most ISIS-produced oil would have remained going between Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Even the three companies would not receive the oil if they did not have a buyer in Israel," unquote. In October, Iraqi security forces captured an Israeli colonel, Yuri Ulen Shahak, working directly with ISIS terrorists. That comes from the article, "Israel Supports ISIS," by Stephen Lendman, posted December 2nd. The problem that Turkey faces now is that the Russian-led coalition is rapidly destroying the infrastructure that provides funding for ISIS, oil refineries, fields, and transport, while gradually retaking territory that was formerly controlled by the many anti-regime or al-Qaeda-linked groups in the north, west, and central parts of the country. In the last few days alone, Russia and company have concluded the encirclement of Syria's biggest city, Aleppo, vaporized a convoy of over 500 oil trucks in the vicinity of Raqqa, and intensified their bombing in the Turkmen Mountains, the Kurdish Mountains, and the Prophet Jonah Mountains. The coalition has moved as far north as Azaz along the Turkish border and recaptured the strategic Aleppo-Raqqa highway, which completely cuts off ISIS supply route from the east in Raqqa. All of the recent progress comes in the wake of the retaking of the strategic Kuwaris airbase, which was the tipping point in the 4.5-year-long conflict. Now the Russian coalition has focused on closing the border, a move that will sever vital supply lines to pro-Turkish militias operating in Syria and force the terrorists to either flee or surrender. That comes from the article, "Putin's Revenge, The Fight for the Border," by Mike Whitney, posted December 2nd, originally appearing at Counterpunch. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Black Lives Matter was spawned in 2013 as a social media hashtag following the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The movement continued to gather momentum in 2014 following the deaths of 18-year-old African-American Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and of Eric Garner, a Staten Island, New York native, both at the hands of police officers. While this anti-racism activism may not have resulted in justice for the multitude of slain African Americans gunned down with impunity by police officials and vigilantes like Zimmerman, the movement at least seems to have raised awareness among citizens inside and outside America of the depth of the problem of racialized justice in the states. Minneapolis, Minnesota may serve as an important case study of this phenomenon. On November 15th, Jamar Clark was fatally shot by police. Multiple witnesses reported Jamar was shot while handcuffed. Anti-racism activists had set up a protest encampment outside the 4th Precinct, demanding the release of the video footage of the killing of the 24-year-old Clark. On Monday, November 23rd, alleged white supremacists fired at unarmed protesters, wounding 5. As this program is being put together on Thursday, December 3rd, the encampment has been taken down by police using bulldozers, and 8 of the protesters have been arrested. 200 Black Lives Matter protesters have taken their demonstration to Minneapolis City Hall. The Global Research NewsHour recently caught up with a longtime activist involved in campaigns to confront police brutality in the Minnesota metropolis. We approached her to get some explanation of the context of police violence being conducted against African Americans and other persons of color in her city. I'm joined right now by Michelle Gross. She is with a group called Communities United Against Police Brutality, a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group. Thank you very much for joining us, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, could you just give us a little bit of background on Communities United Against Police Brutality, how it came together and how it functions?
Sure. We have been together, working together for 15 years. Our organization came together because there had been organizing around police brutality every year in the Twin Cities. There's an annual National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality on October 22nd, and we had been organizing for some years around that. One of the people who spoke at the event, a man named Abuka Sanders, who was well known in the community because he was involved in the spoken word movement, and he was well known. He spoke at our event, and then 8 days later, on November 1st of 2000, he was driving home from working overnight as a personal care attendant for a terminally ill man. He was tired. He was driving the car home so his wife could take the kids to school, and the cops said he was driving erratically. They boxed him in, and they gunned him down. 37 shots. This man was unarmed. And, of course, the community was very inflamed. So we started, you know, doing the Justice for Abuka Sanders thing. We were having protests and sit-ins at City Hall and all of that. And along the way, it occurred to me that the way we were doing this work, by waiting for something bad to happen and then reacting to it, was all wrong. We needed to be much more proactive in terms of, you know, not having to recreate a movement every time something happened, but also in dealing with the day-to-day abuses that lead to the conditions that allowed those bigger incidents to occur. So that's kind of the forming basis of Communities United Against Police Brutality. We're an all-volunteer group, but we've been doing this successfully for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding is that Minneapolis, or in Minnesota, has the highest or among the highest rates of over-prosecution of blacks in the entire nation. Do you have any insights into what's anything unique about your neck of the woods?
Yes, and you're absolutely correct. We do have the highest rate. We're the state with the highest rate of over-prosecution of blacks in the entire country. And our jails are by far the blackest place in our state. And more than that, what's happened here, what's led to this situation is, you know, a lot of people here want to pretend that this place is very liberal and very nice and all of this kind of stuff. But the reality is that this is a very, very racist state. It has racist institutions. This was the state that also historically had the largest massacre occur of American Indians in the entire country, you know, historically. So we have a long history of slaughters of people of color here, and you know, detrimental actions toward people of color that ruin people's lives. Here, like I said, our jails are just, and prisons are just littered with people who, mostly drug war victims and things like that. And so, we've got a huge problem. A big part of that is that this is a very white state. Statewide, African-Americans only make up 3% of the population. Now, in the Twin Cities, African-Americans make up 14% of the population. So it's, you know, but it's still, a small segment of people that experience the wrath of the whites, if you will, you know, how you want to put it. But they really are victimized by these institutions and systems that perpetuate racism.
And I understand the city of Minneapolis has paid millions upon millions of dollars settling cases of police brutality over the last decade and a half.
Oh, yes. Every year, our city, we have 850 officers, sworn officers, and every year our city pays out at least $3,000 in judgments and settlements per officer, you know, which means, and it's not all the officers that are doing it, so it means there's a segment We figure it's in the neighborhood of about 150 to 200 officers that are the most problematic and that cost the city the most money. But yet, even though the city is happy to pay out these settlements and judgments, they are not at all willing to hold these police officers accountable. You know, there's no consequences for the cops for doing this stuff, and that's why it goes on.
Mm-hmm. And so the courts, they're not holding the police agencies accountable, and that points to the idea of judicial impropriety. Has there been complaints leveled against the Judicial Standards Board or some other oversight body?
There is no point in this system anywhere in which police will be held accountable. We'll start with the city itself. We have what we used to have a civilian review authority, and they were not very effective because they weren't given the power or the finances, you know, the resources to do their job. But at least they did sustain some cases. They were never disciplined, but they were sustained. And then, you know, that was at least something. We have been placed now in the last 3 years. The city got rid of that, put into place a thing called the Office of Police Conduct Review. In 3 years, they have heard well over 1,000 cases. Not one single case by a community member has been sustained and disciplined. Not one in 3 years. Now, I'm sorry, you can't tell me that over 1,000 people are liars. That's just wrong. You know, so that starts the problem. Then when people are brutalized by police, they're inevitably arrested and charged falsely with obstructing legal process, disorderly conduct, you know, fifth degree assault on an officer, which is like you could breathe in the guy's face and get that charge, you know. Anything like that. They put these phony charges on people to attempt to justify their brutality. And what they know in the United States is that we have a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Heck versus Humphrey. If you go down on criminal charges in the incident, you have no lawsuit. So this is an attempt to basically prevent a lawsuit. And so people end up, going down criminal charges, or they make a deal or something like that, and then their lawsuit flies out the window. So this is their whole risk management strategy. The bottom line is that it's a misuse of the criminal justice system to try to cover for the officers. The judges are more than willing to go along with it because they believe anything that comes out of a cop's mouth, like it's the Bible or something, and they don't believe things that come from the community, even though they hear them over and over again. And so the judges are biased, very biased, and it just goes on from there. The post board, we have a thing called the post board here, which is the Peace Officer Standard and Training Board. It's the licensing agency of the police. You can file complaints with them, but they fall into a black hole. They go nowhere. We filed 31 complaints with them about grotesque corruption, massive theft by their licensees. There was a whole thing called the Metro Gang Strike Force. It was already exposed in a report that was done by the state attorney general thing. This thing where there was proof that they stole people's cars, they stole money, they brutalized people, they stole their property. And these people had committed no crimes whatsoever. This was a massive criminal enterprise by the police. We filed 31 complaints, on behalf of 31 victims, and the post board did nothing with them. You know, these people engaged in felony conduct, and the post board did nothing against their licenses. So every point in the state where you go to try to get some, accountability for this conduct, at every point the system deliberately puts up roadblocks and deliberately fails to hold police accountable. The situation that happened with Jamar Clark was pretty much inevitable because the system has never held police accountable in this community. And now they're about to try to let these cops walk. I don't know if your listeners know that. They have now announced that they're going to put this in front of a grand jury. And grand jury, when you say I'm going to put it in front of a grand jury, that's code language for we're going to use the grand jury to give ourselves political cover for not bringing charges against these cops. In 150 years, not one single police officer in the state of Minnesota has been indicted by a grand jury for harming a member of the community.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I just wanted to follow up on your previous comments. You're talking about the roadblocks. I'm wondering if it goes beyond that. I mean, retaliation against complainants like yourself. Is there any examples you might want to evoke?
Many. While we were in the middle of pursuing our complaints about the Metro Gang Strike Force, this criminal enterprise, one of the individuals who was one of our complainants suddenly found himself being, you know, followed and the cops showing up at his house all the time. We've had many acts of retaliation. We worked with a case where people, you know, had gotten brutalized the night before on a Sunday night. They went down to City Hall the next morning thinking that they could walk into Internal Affairs and make their complaint. They didn't know that you shouldn't do that because it's a bad idea and that there's retaliation. As they were driving home, the same officers who brutalized them the day before followed them home and brutalized them again. Yeah, there's many incidents like that.
My goodness. And what about white supremacist organizations? Do you see them flourishing in Minneapolis?
They're the kind of ugly underbelly that a lot of people don't want to acknowledge here. Back in 2001, I was part of an organizing that we called Can the Klan. Can, like, put them in a garbage can. And the Klan, the National Socialist Movement, and the all three branches, the skinheads, all three branches of the white supremacy kind of movement in the U.S., came together in the Twin Cities to attempt to have a rally and to do some recruiting in Minnesota. But their plan was essentially to go to all the whitest states in the U.S. and try to form a stronghold. And we had an extremely effective event. Over 4,500 people came out to oppose these people, but they still have gotten some legs under them here. And these guys, four of them actually plotted and planned and attacked the encampment that people had formed outside the 4th Precinct. So they attacked this encampment. They shot activists. They shot people. You know, five different people were shot. They literally just strafed the crowd with bullets. It is lucky that no one was killed. It is lucky that more people were not injured. And yet, you know, we have these big, you know, mass shootings that happen at, like, movie theaters and everything, and everybody gets up in arms about that. But people seem to be fine with people gunning down people at a protest. And, it's really quite outrageous. It's one of the most, you know, most egregious things, because we're talking about gunning people down for exercising their First Amendment rights. And yet, you know, the cops have not taken it seriously. The charges they leveled against these avowed white supremacists who actually plotted this and openly plotted what they were going to do. I mean, we have emails showing where they were talking about who's going to wear what and which guns to bring and all this stuff. So it was planned in advance. That's first degree premeditated murder attempt. And yet these guys have gotten really low-level charges put on them. It's so outrageous. And they're saying, oh, we can't charge them with hate crimes because we can't show it. Well, why can't you show it? I've got the emails. How come you don't? You know, I'm trying to put these in the hands of law enforcement, and they're not interested in getting them. So it's just such nonsense. It is so clear that white supremacy is just down to the core of the institutions in this area.
Yes, you've outlined some outrageous dynamics, and you talked about a grand jury coming down, and it's fairly well understood that this is kind of like a kind of a cover-up type situation where nothing is actually going to get done. How do you see the community reacting to this? Is it going to be more of the same? Is there anything you can disclose about where things go from here?
There's a lot of actions being taken and going to be taken to apply pressure to the county attorney to force him to not use a grand jury. You know, I don't know if that's going to be successful or not. I think we need to do that. It must happen. There's also a separate investigation that's happening by the FBI, but we aren't really convinced that that's going to be all that valuable, because they're doing all the interviewing of the witnesses in tandem, and meaning that they're going to get, you know, we don't think that they're really doing a good job. The main agency that's doing the investigation for the state is called the BCA, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which is like the state version of the FBI.
Could you repeat that? I don't think we quite caught it.
It's called the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and it's about the same as – it's like a state version of the FBI. But most people here call it Bureau of Cop Assistance because, you know, basically – they never hold police accountable. They have screwed the community over and over. No one trusts them. No one believes that they're going to do a good job. And people are starting to have big doubts about whether the FBI is going to do a good job. There's a lot of concerns about that. So, you know, we don't think it's going to be a real great investigation. And even if they were trying legitimately to do a good investigation, the investigation has already been tainted from the start, because in the immediate aftermath of this event, 30 to 40 squad cars descended on the neighborhood. This is a small community. 30 to 40 squad cars, almost all white cops, came barreling out of the cars, pointing guns at people's faces, pointing tasers at people, pepper spraying people, basically, and stealing people's cell phones. So, you know, witnesses are definitely afraid to come forward. You know, I don't even know who all has shown up at these for witness statements, because I've talked to several people, two people in two completely separate circumstances, told me the identical story, that a cop ran up to them, snatched their cell phone out of their face, out of their hands, put a gun to their head, and said, "You better not tell what you saw here, or you're going to end up like that kid over there," referring to Jamar Clark. So, you know, we know that there's been an enormous amount of witness intimidation in this case. And so that has tainted the investigation from the very beginning.
You tend to think, if organized crime was running the city of Minneapolis, would you notice a difference?
Really, you know, they might gun down less black folks, you know, honestly.
Okay, we're almost at the end of our time. Are there any other details or facts of significance you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, again, you know, this is a systematic problem. You know, many people always want to talk about, well, there's bad cops and there's good cops. I always think it's important to point out it's not about bad cops or good cops, but it's about a bad system. And it's a system that refuses to hold police accountable. And when you have a system like that, it's a toxic mix, because it ends up causing people to causing police to feel like they have impunity to do this. So no, it's not every officer doing this. It feels like it's close to the Wild West, but it may not be. But the bottom line is that we have a system that is so completely and utterly dysfunctional, and not just dysfunctional, but willfully dysfunctional, and not holding police accountable, which means that what you have is state-sanctioned violence. And that's, you know, the reason why we are working so hard to get at these underlying causes of this problem. There are some solutions. We are working hard on those solutions. One of the main ones we're working on is requiring police officers to carry their own professional liability insurance, so that they would have a personal consequence if they engage in this conduct. You know, if they cause their insurance company to pay out more money, their premiums are going to go up, or they might become uninsurable and we can get rid of these guys. So there are solutions that we're working on. This is a very intractable problem. It's a hard problem, but we, like I said, we are working on solutions. And people, you know, I hope people will get involved, and wherever you live, get involved. You know, your listeners can look up more information at www.cuapb.org.
Michelle Gross, thank you very much for sharing those insights with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michelle Gross is an organizer with the Communities United Against Police Brutality, a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Will air an interview with prominent African-American essayist and commentator Abayomi Azikiwe in just moments. But first, we'll play a song. Here's legendary recording artist Gil Scott-Heron with the song "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised" from the 1971 album Pieces of a Man. Stay tuned.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from the Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The
revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Report from 29 District. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
A string of racially charged incidents involving police brutality and impunity for law officials has galvanized Americans by the tens of thousands to stage demonstrations and civil disobedience actions across the U.S. The hashtag Black Lives Matter has come into prominence and is waking up all races within and outside the continental United States to the ongoing reality of racial disharmony and social inequality in what's called the land of the free and the home of the brave. Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Jamar Clark, just a few names on the roster of those killed in cold blood with no acceptable punitive actions taken against the offenders. Add to this the high incarceration rate of men of color, and it becomes clear that there are systemic problems affecting race that need to be addressed and confronted. To help contextualize the epidemic of police and legal violence against the people of color, we're joined by Abayomi Azikiwe. He is the editor of Pan-African Newswire, an outspoken and frequent commentator on issues of African and world affairs. Many of his essays are published at the Global Research website. It's good to have you with us, Abayomi Azikiwe.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I was wondering, first of all, what are we to make of this phenomenon? Are we talking about just something about our law enforcement system that attracts racists? Or is there some sort of like a conscious conspiracy to subdue and criminalize people of color from the beat level on up to state agencies like the FBI? What is your take on that?
It's a combination of both. You have a system that was born in racism, in genocide, in forced removal. And therefore, in order to maintain that system, a state apparatus was put into place in order to oppress as well as contain those who were the center of this form of exploitation. If you look at the forced removal of the native people of the United States, it was done over a period of approximately two centuries in a very brutal and a very dismissive fashion. The importation of millions of people of African descent who were brought into the United States as slaves from 1619 all the way up to the illegal abolition of slavery in 1865. The entire political economy of the United States was based on forced removal, enslavement and super exploitation. We look during the so-called antebellum period. That's the period after the independence of the U.S. From Britain up until the Civil War. The major engine of the economy was the production of agricultural goods, and later on, particularly cotton. And as a result of the production and exploitation of cotton, that slavery flourished inside the United States, particularly in the South, but it had also been very widespread on the East Coast, as well as other parts of the country, even in the Midwest. I believe that this factor plays into how African people, African Americans, are perceived by the ruling interests inside the United States. Even after the conclusion of the Civil War, the failure of Reconstruction, which lasted at least on a federal level for approximately 12 years, and then on a state level, it was able to survive up until the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries. You still had institutionalized racism. There was lynchings. There was close collaboration between groups such as the Ku Klux Klan and local law enforcement agencies. You had courts, and you had laws that specifically were designed for the repression of African Americans. Even today, some 50 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, there is massive discrimination and oppression against African Americans. It has come to the light very starkly in the last 3 years with such high-profile cases as the vigilante killing of Trayvon Martin. There was the police killing of Michael Brown in 2014. Also, the killing of Eric Garner. And the most recent upheavals centered around the shooting of Jamar Clark in Minneapolis and the release of a video of the killing of McDonald, Laquan McDonald in Chicago, 17-year-old African-American youth that was shot 16 times as he was walking away from the police. So these are how these reasons are connected to the history of the development of the United States all the way up until the present, where, of course, we have the police who are reinforcing this same system of national oppression and super exploitation.
Now, the extent to which these killings have become national news, is that a reflection of some kind of a resurgence, or it's been going on all the time? It's only now that the cameras are out and it's getting as much attention as it's getting. What is your sense of that?
Well, the FBI does not necessarily keep records of the police killings of particularly African Americans in any type of systematic and efficient way. You've had publications that have done studies, leading U.S. publications that reveal that thousands upon people have been killed over the last two decades by the police, not only African Americans, but people from other national minorities as well as whites. I think now there is a system that is developing among community organizations, non-governmental organizations, certain periodicals and journals that are doing a better job at documenting the frequency and the severity of these killings. Also, the advent of social media, the internet as well, allows people to communicate even in a media framework with millions and even billions of people instantaneously. So there's a greater awareness. There's a much better form of communication between activists, those in the communities, and also communications outwardly towards the national and international community. Now, what we've seen in the last 3 years, it appears it is a rash of intolerance and brutal and deadly force being exercised by the police. This is happening from rural areas all the way to small towns and suburbs such as Ferguson, Missouri, which only had 21,000 people living in it, to Baltimore, which is a major municipality in the southeast, to Minneapolis, where over the last two decades, a lot of African Americans have migrated there from Chicago and other cities in the Midwest due to the shifting economic character of the United States. I believe that there is a greater awareness, a greater sensitivity, and we've seen the struggle against police brutality and police killings, in a sense, merging with a new movement coming off of the campuses, starting at some of the most elite universities in the United States, the University of Missouri, Columbia, Princeton, Georgetown, Brown University, which have had demonstrations led by African-American students against institutional racism, against symbols of racism. For example, at Princeton, demanding the closing of the Woodrow Wilson Center. And there's been numerous demonstrations all across the United States targeting buildings that are named after former slave owners. Presidents such as Woodrow Wilson, who were ideological racists. I believe that this level of sensitivity and activism and organization and mobilization is going to continue, because the federal government, along with the corporate community, really has no program to address these issues. If we look at the actual economic status of African Americans, they lost tremendously during the Great Recession, beginning in 2007, 2008, and actually the losses began much earlier than that because of the so-called dot-com boom collapse of the early 2000s. During the Great Recession, African communities lost their homes to the hundreds of thousands in states like Michigan and other areas throughout the United States. And they have not recovered from that. You have an unemployment rate in the United States where African Americans have twice the rate of joblessness than the national average. You have to look at the level of social wealth, household wealth, accumulated household debt. All of these factors are contributing to this degree of intolerance and also anger that is rising among African Americans.
Mm. So then do you see a correlation then between economic hardship and economic inequality and these gestures of police and judicial violence?
Yes, because the focus from a public policy level has been on the elimination of crime in major urban areas and also in suburbs and even in rural areas. And African Americans are identified as being disproportionately involved in criminal activity. They are targeted specifically for that purpose, and as a result of that, they are overrepresented in the prison industrial complex. So you have, from a proportional standpoint, far more African Americans incarcerated in the United States than you do whites. That doesn't mean that more African Americans use illegal drugs. They commit crimes, but they are treated differently by the courts. They are racially profiled. For example, the federal government did a study of Ferguson and St. Louis County last year, which they released. It was entitled the Ferguson Report, and it indicated that local municipalities in St. Louis County were deliberately targeting African-American motorists for being stopped, for being issued three, sometimes four citations per stop. And as a result of that, you had approximately 12,000 outstanding warrants against mainly African Americans in a city of 21,000 people. So that was an average, it was calculated by the New York Times, of two outstanding warrants, a lot of which are derived from traffic citations per household in Ferguson, Missouri. I mean, it was a huge aspect of the federal government's report on Ferguson. And despite all of this, the government said that there was still not enough probable cause for the police and the local municipal officials to be prosecuted under federal law. Now, they did apparently make some arrangements for these people, high-ranking officials, the police chiefs, some people involved in the courts, that they would resign in exchange for not being prosecuted. However, this phenomena is not just centered in Ferguson, Missouri. This is a pattern that can be replicated all across the United States.
I was wondering if we could go back to the movements of the 50 years ago, the 60s. You had the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee right up through the rise of the Black Panthers with these same issues out in the open. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to maybe briefly assess what have been the successes and the failures of those movements of 5 decades ago in confronting institutional racism in America.
The success centered around the passage of legislation, as I alluded to earlier, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But what is often not known by many people is that there was an attempt to pass a civil rights bill in 1966 that would have guaranteed fair housing and an elimination of housing discrimination and other issues in the United States. Well, what was happening in 1966? This was after the Watts Rebellion of 1965. During 1966, there was urban rebellions in dozens of cities across the country. The slogan Black Power became extremely popular inside the United States. It contended with the more what was considered mainstream or moderate slogans and demands as advocated by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference under Dr. Martin Luther King. These developments pushed King further to the left. So by 1966, he was calling for much more stringent measures on the part of the government. Now, mind you, this was after the passage of these two major civil rights bills the two preceding years. In 67, there were even more urban rebellions. They reached their highest level with over 164 urban rebellions, according to the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorder that was impaneled after the Detroit Rebellion of 1967. And, of course, King came out solidly against the war in Vietnam. He linked the war in Vietnam to the failure of the United States to address its own internal problems, to eliminate poverty, to thoroughly eliminate institutionalized racism. He also looked at U.S. foreign policy and essentially declared it as being imperialistic. He was killed in 1968 while he was in Memphis working with sanitation employees who were seeking recognition as a trade union. So we can see that King himself was moving more to the left. He never abandoned nonviolence per se, but who knows, if he had have lived, he may have become more aligned with Black Power and some of the revolutionary movements that were evolving at the time. The Black Panther Party, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Republic of New Africa, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, all of these organizations saw the need for a fundamental transformation of U.S. society. That movement was attacked as well by the federal government through the counterintelligence program, which influenced local police agencies to target their activists and organizations, round them up, put them under false charges, utilize the media to denigrate their efforts. And of course, this had a tremendous blow against the movement overall. And then at the same time, there was an opening up of the political structures inside the United States. So they utilized the notion of the ability to integrate within U.S. society through running for public office, opening up new job categories to African Americans. Those who weren't willing to accept that could face either death by the police, framing by law enforcement agencies and the courts, or many, of course, being driven into exile as well. These are multifaceted methods that have been used over the last five decades to contain and also suppress the African-American people, not to mention the rapid increase in the prison industrial complex, the 500% increase in the number of people who are incarcerated in the United States over the last three and a half decades. These are serious issues, and they are not given attention even by the White House that is now run by a person who is of African descent. There's been no major public policy initiatives launched by the Obama administration to do anything to correct the structural unemployment among African Americans, the high rate of incarceration, the level of militarization of the police, and also the fight to stop this type of racial profiling and victimization by law enforcement.
Mm. So that brings us up to the movement of today with Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. How would you assess it? Is that do you see it as enduring, as being resilient, or is there some signs already of it being I don't know, contained or co-opted or otherwise thwarted?
It's not a uniform movement. There have been efforts to turn it into a more systematic and organized force, but it's really not possible at this time because it just evolved 3 years ago. But it's part of a broader struggle, a struggle to bring about the realization of the unfinished quest for civil rights, human rights, national liberation, economic equality. You have different political tendencies within the anti-racist movement in the United States at this time. So it's going to have to play itself out in the streets, on the campuses, and in the workplaces. And we see that taking place in a myriad of fashions right now. So we're looking forward to how the movement is going to take on these monumental issues. For example, last year, people started to march into shopping malls, particularly during the holiday seasons, which is a very, very important time period for the capitalist system here in the United States. We saw an escalation of that last weekend during Black Friday, where in Chicago, they were able to shut down for several hours the so-called Magnificent Mile retail district. Thousands, largely African-Americans, but others, were able to block store entrances. And this, of course, had a tremendous impact on the politics in Chicago and also nationally. The sales were down across the country because African Americans had said through social media, through urban radio, that people should stay out of the malls as long as the police are not respecting our right to exist, to due process. So it's having an impact on the bottom line of the system. This week, Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff under Barack Obama and now the mayor of Chicago, announced the forced resignation of Chicago's police superintendent and also the establishment of a task force. Now, what the real impact this is going to have in the long run, of course, may not be very much, but it shows that even with limited organization, that the situation is so critical and that the overall system inside the United States is so fragile now in terms of its economic status. I mean, we hear a lot of propaganda about the recession being over and about the recovery being strong. But if we look at the actual data, and even some of the leading periodicals in the financial community know that the so-called recovery is extremely, extremely fragile, and that any extended racial explosion or outbreak of unrest in key urban areas across the United States could be devastating, not only to the image of the United States, but also to the overall social stability of the country.
I wanted to ask just maybe if you could comment about perhaps less spectacular forms of racial violence. I mean, not necessarily police killings, but you know, more subtle forms such as, you know, maybe the power dynamics in the classroom, portrayals in the media, maybe the representation in the labor force, and so on. Are there things that you would advise the movement to pay attention to that may not make the headline news, as it were?
There have been attacks on public education in urban areas. The lessening of funding by the federal government as well as state governments for education in urban areas, the massive laying off of teachers, the charterization of public schools, the attacks on teachers' unions, also the lessening of federal revenue-sharing monies coming into the cities, causing the closing of recreational centers, the privatization of municipal services, the forced bankruptcy of the city of Detroit in 2013 and 2014 was heavily racially oriented, the whole approach. Detroit is the largest populated African-American municipality in the United States. It has a tremendous history of African-American civil rights, black empowerment, also labor rights. Many of the organizations in the 20th century were started in Detroit. The Nation of Islam was started here. The Republic of New Africa was started in Detroit. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers was started in Detroit. Detroit had the largest urban rebellion during 1967, prior to any other time in the history of the United States. So it's not an accident that cities like Detroit, cities like Chicago, are being targeted for these privatization efforts and efforts to further disempower oppressed people.
Okay, I just want to maybe conclude with one last question, and you kind of alluded to it with your comments about King moving in a more radical direction toward the end of his life. And that has to do with that umbrella, that capitalist, imperialist order that's, overseeing all of this. Can racial justice in America be successfully attained within that capitalist imperialist order, or must that structure by necessity be toppled?
I believe that the U.S. has to transform economically and politically out of the capitalist imperialist system into socialism. And I think that that is the only way you can really tackle this problem. The current system being structured the way it is cannot at this point institute the type of reforms that were even carried out 50 years ago during the 1960s, where after the Detroit Rebellion in 1967, Ford Motor Company set up hiring centers in black communities where they brought in thousands of people to work. No multinational corporation right now inside the United States is in a position to hire tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of people who are unemployed or underemployed. So this is the major contradiction that we face right now, that the system is such that it cannot effectively reform itself, even under massive pressure. So I think that the next step will be a further erosion of the stability of the system, and that has to be matched by the degree of organization and coordination and mobilization on the part of the oppressed, along with all people who are for fundamental change to bring about a new era in U.S. history.
Well, Abayomi Azikiwe, I really appreciate your sharing your thoughts and insights with us on this very special and topical subject. Thank you for joining us.
And thank you.
We've been joined by the editor of Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe. He's an outspoken and frequent commentator on issues of African and world affairs. Many of his essays are published at the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.